We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
This is Focus, our morning talk show. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Millions of Americans have lost homes as a result of the collapse of the housing market. Millions more may yet face foreclosure. More than $1 trillion in wealth has been lost. In this hour of the show, we'll try to take a look at the mortgage crisis and foreclosures generally, but also specifically, we'll look at Illinois. And our guest for the program is sociologist Cedric Herring from University of Illinois at Chicago. He's one of the contributors to the most recent edition of the Illinois Report, and this is something that has been put out every year now for a number of years by the Institute of Government and Public Affairs at the University of Illinois, and takes a look at Illinois and Illinois government, some of the problems affecting the state, and there are individual chapters that have to do, for example, with what's going on with the mortgage crisis, but also things like health care and school reform and so forth. It's something that you can get as a paper item from the Government Institute of Government and Public Affairs. But also, you can read it online if you would like to do that. You can go to their website and find out more about it. And as we talk this morning with our guest, we would be happy to have questions and comments from people who are listening. Now, we do ask people to try to be brief and be on the topic. That way we'll get in as many callers as possible. But certainly your input is welcome. 333-9455 is the number here in Champaign-Urbana. We have a toll-free line. That's good anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. And if you'd like to send an email, you can do that too. That is, the address is will-talk. So it's just like it sounds, W-I-L-L-talk at illinois.edu. So at any point here, if you're interested, you can participate in the program. And Professor Herring, hello.
Thank you. I'm happy to be with you.
Well, thanks very much for talking with us. We can talk in a couple of ways here with two different frames, and I'm hoping we can do that both. Again, talking a little bit about what's happened nationally here, but also we want to talk specifically about the state of Illinois. And I guess just nationally, we probably don't need to remind people about the pace of foreclosures in this country. Now, just recently, there's been a little bit of a dip because of some issues in the way the foreclosures were being processed.
Absolutely.
But if you take a look at just the sheer numbers, and for example, in the report, there are numbers that just that show a very steady pace of foreclosure quarter after quarter, close sort of around 900,000 or in some cases more. So we're getting in the million per quarter vicinity, going all the way back to say spring of 2009. Can you just give us some of those numbers?
Well, as you suggested, it has been a steady pace of nearly a million foreclosures per quarter, basically since we have reached the height of the Great Recession. And so, you know, people differ in terms of when they put the timing of that. But as you suggested, we have hit nearly a million per quarter since the spring of 2009. And those numbers just seem to be steady. And as you suggested, there was a bit of a dip, but people might remember that what actually happened in 2010 was that all of the 50 states' attorneys general sued mortgage companies basically to say that they had to put a halt to some of the foreclosure proceedings because of there being questions about whether all of the proper procedures and things like that had been followed in terms of even knowing who was owed money and whether it was legitimate for companies to foreclose upon properties and things like that and the so-called robo-signing scandal and things like that. And so there was a brief halt and, in fact, some decline, but some of that is due to just that kind of process.
And then what's happened with that just recently now? Has the pace picked up to what it had been, the pace of foreclosures, what it had been before this moratorium? Or I know some people are saying that they're concerned that if it hasn't happened, it will happen.
Well, what you've had is lending institutions taking a fundamentally different kind of strategy in terms of pursuing foreclosures. And there's now such a backlog of houses and homes and things like that in the pipeline that they have slowed down that process to some degree. And some people would say because it has the strategy for them making money on this process has fundamentally shifted. And so you still have the same number of homes going into foreclosure. But by foreclosure, we don't mean houses being repossessed. And so the number of repossessions has actually dipped a bit, but the number of foreclosures continues its climb.
So does that mean that people are still in their homes, but the future of their being in their homes is in question?
Right. And so what you actually have is a longer process for people to go from the actual notice of foreclosure to their being if you were talking about a rental process, being evicted. So we don't talk about evictions when we're talking about foreclosures, but people basically being displaced from their homes. So the process is taking longer now, and some of that is because of the cease and desist with the robo-signing stuff and a backlog of houses that are on the markets and basically lending institutions not having good strategies for how to handle the overwhelming kind of excess of housing stock.
I'd like to place Illinois here nationally in terms of foreclosures, and we have certainly heard about places where the numbers have been the highest, and I guess we can say that Illinois is not the worst. So compared with places like Florida and California and Arizona, they are in worse shape, but Illinois, it looks as if Illinois is maybe among the top 10 states in terms of foreclosures.
Yes, it is. The real difference between Illinois and states like Florida and California, Arizona, that you suggested, is that many of those states like California, Florida, Arizona have basically peaked in terms of, it's one of those good news, bad news kinds of things. The good news is that the rate of foreclosures has topped out in those states. The bad news is that the rates were so high that they basically couldn't go much higher without, we're talking crisis as it is, but the numbers were just alarming in those states, and they have basically topped out and have now leveled off in terms of the rates. In Illinois, the rates continue to climb, however, and it's similar in some other Midwestern states like Michigan and Ohio and places where the foreclosure rates continue to climb despite the notion that our economy is improving. And what we also see are continuing prices of homes just continue to drop in addition to that.
That's, I think that in talking about, and we've talked about this before on the program, it's gotten extensive coverage in national media. And I think that when people talk about this and when they ask this question, well, what happened and why did it happen, that people, I think, don't often consider just how complex a thing this was. And they tend to pick one or two things to point to as being the problem. For example, overvalued housing. Or subprime lending, where we have borrowers that perhaps weren't qualified for their mortgages, or mortgage vehicles that maybe gave people a very attractive interest rate and monthly payment to start, something they could live with, but later that changed and they got in to over their heads because they couldn't make their monthly payment. And then if you figure in also the fact that we have an economic downturn, and maybe we had people who lost their jobs, one might wonder, well, if that hadn't have happened, maybe some more people could have held on. They would have had a difficult time making their monthly payment, but, you wonder, well, maybe they could at least have made the payment somehow and have stayed in their homes. So it seems as if there are a whole bunch of things here that all came together to make this as bad as it is.
Absolutely. I would say that you've named a number of those factors. There is another one that people tend to overlook, though, and that is, again, we have to look at what is the strategy for making money off of mortgages as a vehicle for investment. And basically what happened that was qualitatively different in the 2000s is that we had what's called securitization of mortgages. And that is where instead of homes being, you know, you go to a lender and you get a mortgage and you then deal with that lender and you make your monthly payments. What happened that was qualitatively different is that several mortgages, thousands of mortgages, were bundled together and sold as investments to people on Wall Street. And where it is the case where if one mortgage goes bad, then the bank would deal with that one person and they would foreclose upon them. But when you have them bundled, it becomes a mess when, in fact, several of these go bad. And it is like a bad investment. And so when we heard things about the quote-unquote Wall Street bailout, it was really, much of this had to do with the securitization of mortgages. And so many of these financial giants that people started hearing about, Bears and Stearns, AIG, it was about this. And when we had the so-called bailout of Wall Street, under the Bush administration, when we were told that our economy was about to go off a cliff, this is what was underlying reason, that Wall Street had made so many, let's call them bad investments, extremely risky investments. And so you talked about things like subprime lending and things like this. We tend to think of those as being things where unqualified borrowers got loans. But in fact, what happened is that Wall Street basically said, well, we can share the risk and we can minimize this and we can bundle these bad investments together. And so if 10% of them go bad, it's not so bad. But what happens when 20% of them, 25% of them, 30% of them go bad? And that's really what happened, is that you just had an overwhelming number of bad decisions and an overwhelming number of bad investments that came due at the same time. At the same time that we started the grips of the recession, and it made it very difficult for people who, in the past, if people were behind with things like their mortgages, many times what they would do is they would refinance. And so, you know, you say you refinance, you get different terms, and perhaps your house is appreciated in value. And so even though it's an uncomfortable situation, you're able to readjust. But what happens when there's no room to refinance and credit gets tight? Then it makes a complete mess. And that's what really happened, is that we had this mess of the subprime, and it was like the perfect storm is the way a lot of people saw it.
Yeah. I think it's just to underscore the point, I think it's important to point to this fact that while there always was a secondary market for mortgages, that is, you know, one bank loans me money to buy my house, and then it holds that mortgage for a little while, but then somebody else comes along and they buy that mortgage from bank number one. Bank number two buys the mortgage, and so bank number two may hold a number of mortgages, and I'm sure that they would not want any of them to go bad. But if they were diversified enough, and the level of risk was diversified enough, then if one or two, a few went bad, well, you know, they could live with that. What they did was they concentrated the risk by putting all the riskiest stuff together in one box, and then they're just creating this opportunity for a big problem if a lot of their risky mortgages.
Right, and we have to understand that there were certain institutions that were actually counting on, I mean, and it sounds horrible, but it's the nature of investment, counting on a number of these going bad. Mm-hmm. So it's like some people were betting that these investments would go bad, and they would make money by doing that. And then there, I mean, because, you know, because if a mortgage goes bad, traditionally what happens is that you still have the underlying property. And so if it goes bad, you can make money by claiming that property. But what happens when you have lent more money than the property is worth, which is what we also had.
Mm-hmm.
And when property values drop so substantially, even when a person borrowed, I mean, so we had things that were like interest-only loans. So, you know, the traditional notion of making a 20% down payment and then paying it off over 30 years, well, that was out the door. So it wasn't just subprime loans that we're talking about, but it was interest-only loans. And so a person could borrow 100% of the value of their home and then only pay enough to cover the interest on that loan. And so as long as that was working, banks and other mortgage companies made money off of that. But when houses started dropping in value, and when more and more people couldn't make even those interest-only payments, it put a squeeze on the system. And when you then go to claim that property, you find that, okay, so let's just use an example. You've lent out $300,000 for a property, but then you find out that it's only worth $200,000. If you're a lending institution, you're now left holding the bag for $100,000 per house. And that cannot be sustained at any level for any long period of time. And that's what we really had.
We have a caller here. Let me introduce again the guest for this hour. Cedric Herring is professor of sociology in the Department of Sociology at University of Illinois Chicago. He's also affiliated with the University of Illinois Institute of Government and Public Affairs and was a contributor to their Illinois Report 2011, wrote an article about the mortgage crisis and specifically about how policymakers in Illinois have tried to address it. It's something that you can read if you go on to go to the website of the Institute of Government and Public Affairs. Questions here are welcome to 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. And we have someone here to talk with in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Yeah, hi. We have another wave, or I don't know when that was started, and it'd be interesting to know what percentage of that one is the home equity, where people are using their homes as sort of ATMs. You know, it's sort of sad that our economy is so based on consumers. I think it was 70%. So do you cover this at all, or how much of a factor that's been? Because,
well, it is very much a related problem, because, like I said, if people are able to refinance. We used to not think of that as being a problem. And so if you had a home that was appreciating in value, and so you originally got a loan for $250,000, but then it appreciated up to $300,000, and you were able to borrow that $50,000, that's fine and good, as long as the house is actually worth that much. But what if that is not really the case, and you borrowed that $50,000, and then your house actually went from $250,000 down to $200,000, and you're unable to make that loan repayment, then the people who lent you that money really can't turn to your house to get that money back, which is what used to be able to happen. And so I'm saying this crisis became just that kind of thing. So you use the analogy of an ATM machine, and I'm saying it's something that as long as housing is appreciating in value, people thought of it as not really creating a problem. But this was, in fact, the so-called bubble that people saw in the early 2000s, that we said that housing prices could not continue to rise at the rate and at the pace that they were. But, you know, so it made it difficult for new buyers, but it made it a situation that current owners often appreciated, because people could use fictional money to finance new cars or college education or other kinds of things that people like to have cash for. But it made it very difficult if there's really no equity in the house.
The other question I have is what about within the state of Illinois? Which cities have been hit the hardest?
Well, I don't think it would surprise people to know that Chicago Chicago and Cook County in particular has been, I won't say devastated, but the rates became so high in Cook County that Cook County could not keep up with processing the foreclosures. And beyond that, I mean, you do have basically larger cities in Illinois, which is where this is happening. So that's basically as specific as I can get with that. But Cook County was closely devastated with this kind of situation and with houses, I mean, townhomes and, the word is escaping me right now, but not co-ops. But
condominiums?
Condos, there you go, condos.
Well, one of the things that really struck me when you break it down, in the report, you take a look at who, by various, breaking it down demographically various ways, who was affected. And the thing that I was really struck by was that most of the people here are people that I would think of as solidly middle class or above, with the people who were most likely to be in foreclosure were people who had incomes between $50,000 and $100,000, and even significant numbers of people with incomes in excess of $100,000 were facing foreclosure.
Absolutely. I mean, but it's for the reason that your caller just mentioned, is that these were often the people who could, in fact, access equity in their homes. But then when that equity disappears and they are they have the money, but they see the price of or the value of their home drop so substantially. I'm not saying that people oftentimes walk away when they're upside down in a home or underwater in a home, but that does happen. And sometimes it's just not, quote-unquote, rational for people to continue to pay when the value is not there. And so it really is oftentimes people with higher incomes who are able to do that, because people with low incomes and homes that are worth very little don't have much equity in those homes to begin with. And so they really can't get into the same kind of hundreds of thousands of dollars of being underwater as a person who has $1 million home.
Mm-hmm. We have another caller. This is someone in Joliet. We'll talk with them next on our line 4. Hello.
Yes, hello.
Yes.
Yes, sir. I have a question, please, for the professor, the speaker, I believe.
Yes.
I'm not very sophisticated in investment and et cetera, but I was particularly interested that at the height of the controversy, this was perhaps a year and a half ago, you'll remember that there was a major interview on the national networks with a lady, shall I call her a mayor? She was a banking specialist in Norway. And the result was that they bought some of these bundles. And she later testified on the Norwegian television and on national television that, quote, this was explained to us in such a way that we honestly did not understand it, even though we persisted with questions to understand how this would affect us as foreign buyers of these bundles, and the way in which it came across to the press. And so I'm asking the professor, were these presented to other institutions that were purchasing, in this case, the particular city in Norway, were these presented by our Wall Street people, or the banking people, in such a way that they were virtually not understandable, which would be a part of the dishonesty behind this, because the way in which the purchasers of these bundles from our, I guess, Wall Street institutions was so intentionally poorly explained that not even investment people could properly understand them, and so we created havoc in other markets. Thank you. That's my question.
Right. Well, I don't know. Is that something, Professor Herring, that you feel like you can...
Well, my report doesn't cover this, but I guess what I'm saying is that people come to trust those who they're taking investment advice from, And so I could see how that would be true. And I know that there are oftentimes when people will follow the advice of experts and they can't follow every detail of what the expert is saying. But I guess in this case, these were things that were sold to people on the basis of you really can't lose with this kind of proposition, and look at how much money you could make. And I think that's where, and what you also have is the notion that if this ever gets too bad, the federal government will step in and won't let these bad investments happen the way that they ordinarily would happen with a market. And you did have some of that happening, both under the Bush administration and the Obama administration. And so people say moral hazard, we should have let these people suffer, and you still have people who say let these people who made bad decisions suffer. But it has an impact on innocent bystanders, the neighbor, the taxpayer, the people who are also brought down by the drag on the economy that this has. Hmm.
Well, just I think I find myself going back to the an important fact here, important reality here, and I think that it's in play whether you're talking about an individual borrowing money to buy a home or you're talking about some kind of institutional investor, and that is going back to this idea that we don't have it now, but we had, that the value of property would never go down.
Right.
That it would continue to go up. So if you paid a certain amount of money, that you had this this almost certainty that sometime in the near future you could sell that property for more. Or if your payments really went up to the point where you felt that you couldn't afford them, either you could sell and maybe even make some money, or at the very least you could refinance. Again, based on the idea that the value of the property had increased over time.
Well, I think you're absolutely right that for so long, housing prices, real estate prices continued to go up. And it's not just that they were keeping pace with inflation. Housing prices were far outpacing inflation. And it was another bubble. I don't know if people remember the dot-com bubble, where people thought, oh, that could never go away. You know, all you have to do is invest in the dot-com startups, and that burst. And this was another kind of thing like that, where people just thought there is no limit to it. But at some point, value has to be related to actual value in the home and in the marketplace and things like that. And it's almost like people ignored the laws of economics.
Yeah. This is Focus. I'm David Inge. My guest this morning, Cedric Herring. He's a professor of sociology at the University of Illinois Chicago. We're talking about the mortgage crisis, and we'll talk some more about how policymakers in Illinois have tried to respond. We'll have more after a short break. This is Focus.
Come sort through thousands of CDs, DVDs, tapes, and albums, plus stereo equipment for the 2011 vintage vinyl. This Saturday, at our new site, the former Altman's Billiards and Barstool Supply, 301 West Market View Drive, Champaign. Proceeds benefit the Illinois Radio Reader. For sale hours, visit will.illinois.edu.
Support for Focus comes from Bodywork Associates, bringing precision neuromuscular massage therapy to Champaign-Urbana since 1982 with four area locations, including inside the ARC, the Illini Student Union, and on Windsor Road in Champaign. More information is available at bodyworkassociates.com.
This is Focus. We're here weekday mornings with 10 different topics for you. Tomorrow morning in the 10 o'clock hour, our guest is Julian Howarth. He teaches at Yale, and we'll be talking about the European Union and security issues in Europe now in the post-Cold War era. Also on the program Friday morning in the 10 o'clock hour this hour, our guest will be Joel Brinkley. He's a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist. He teaches at Stanford, and we will be talking about Cambodia. That's the subject of a new book that he has authored, Cambodia's Curse, The Modern History of a Troubled Land. You can check out the schedule for the entire week by going to our website. That way you can also listen to past programs. That's will.illinois.edu. In this hour, of Focus. The guest is Cedric Herring. He's a professor of sociology at University of Illinois Chicago. He's also affiliated with the U of I Institute of Government and Public Affairs, and he contributed a chapter to their Illinois report for 2011. Looks at a number of political issues here in the state of Illinois, and his chapter was about the mortgage crisis, and you can read it online or get a copy from the Institute. We also have a number of callers here. In fact, the lines are full. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Professor Herring, just before we go on to some other callers, one thing I do want to make sure that we try to spend at least a couple of minutes here with, and it's something that you do in the report, is to try to take a look at how it is in Springfield. Lawmakers, people in state government, have tried to address the issue of foreclosure and people losing their homes in Illinois, because certainly state government has tried to respond.
Sure. And I know that there are still ongoing hearings that different legislators are having about this whole issue. But there, as you suggested, in Illinois, there have been a number of things that the state has tried to do. For example, Governor Quinn signed into law what's known as the Homeowner Protection Act, and the General Assembly unanimously passed this. And what the idea behind this was to give homeowners who fell behind on their mortgage payments time to work with their lenders to develop plans that would allow them to stay in their homes. And so it gave them, if you approached your lender and said that you were having problems, it basically gave you a 90-day grace period to stave off foreclosure proceedings. So in some sense, that buys time, but that doesn't fundamentally shift the underlying problem. And you've had other things that have you had a bill that was introduced in the House that implemented a pilot program to assist workers who had lost their jobs. And it was the same kind of thing, where they were to approach their lenders and to work out arrangements for them to make partial payments and to get some kind of time delay. But ultimately, if a person has lost their job and is unable to make payments, ultimately, even if it's after a 90-day period, a lender still will start those foreclosure proceedings and try to repossess the house. You've also had things like the introduction of counseling programs. You've had a bill in Illinois that also made it illegal for companies to engage in these illegitimate robo-signing kinds of proceedings. And so you've now had legislation that requires that, at least in Illinois, that these lenders prove by clear and convincing evidence that they are, in fact, due the payments. Because, like I said, with the robo-signing scandal, it wasn't even clear sometimes, because mortgages had been sold and resold and packaged and bundled and things like that, who payments were even due to. And so you've had legislation to clear up that kind of thing. And so those are some of the kinds of things that have been done in Illinois. But while they might have helped in individual cases, they have not stopped this ongoing crisis. And perhaps there's some other things that need to be done to try to work through those kinds of issues.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the things that you point to is that another serious issue here, not only would be looking at a situation where a family would be losing their home and whatever equity they had managed to accumulate, but then there's the real practical issue of needing a place to live.
Right.
And it can be very difficult for people to find some place. Renting out of a situation like that, if you've lost your home and you're having financial difficulties, then to try to find some apartment or some other place to rent can be extremely difficult.
Well, absolutely. And in fact, we actually have to ask ourselves the following. Is it in the best whose interest is it in? If a house goes through foreclosure, whose interest is it for that house to be vacant? It's definitely not in the interest of the homeowner. It's probably not in the interest of the mortgage company to have a vacant property. And if houses are very difficult to sell because of credit issues, and the market just being so down and there being such a backlog of houses, is it in their interest? Is it in the interest of local and state governments that would not receive revenue from taxes that would be due on those properties? I would suggest that it's really in no one's interest. And so for that reason, we need to start thinking outside the box in terms of what to do with this. And so you suggested that that we need to have provisions for people who are displaced. And I'm saying one real solution actually might be to do things that would keep people in their homes, even though they are in the process of being foreclosed upon. And one idea that has been put forth is what's called deed for lease programs, mm-hmm. in which people actually would acknowledge that they are, in fact, behind on their payments and facing foreclosure, but then they would sign a lease or a voluntary transfer of the deed of the property back to the lender with the idea that they could continue to make payments, at least the payments that they could afford. And so the lender then receives a partial payment. The house is not vacant, and you can still have some revenue going to local and state government entities, and it stops neighborhoods from decaying. It stops uprooting families. It stops property values from completely plummeting within those neighborhoods. And I'm saying that this is not a long-term solution, but it is something that would forestall the panic and the crisis kind of situation that we have right now. There are some other things that could also be done, a proposal that I've put forth, and it gets a little bit complicated to be confusing to some people, but it's what I call a property tax escrow exchange, in which property taxes, which for some people are a fairly substantial part of the mortgage that they pay, mm-hmm. you know, that those funds be set aside, not so much that they are set aside, but that that the county basically not receive those funds, but instead those funds actually go to the lender. But in return, the lender would give credit to the homeowner at a rate of 1.5 times the equivalent. So in other words, if you have a property tax that is, let's say, $500 as part of your mortgage, that those $500 would then be worth $750 towards the payment on your mortgage. But the county then wouldn't receive that tax money until much later, until the situation can be cleared up. And again, it's just something that helps to buy time for people and stops it's like we have arterial bleeding right now. And so we have to do something to stop the bleeding before we can get a more permanent fix to these kinds of things.
Yeah, I can imagine cash-strapped local governments not being real happy about the idea of not getting the tax revenue.
The thing is, when these homes go into foreclosure, they don't get tax revenue
anyway. And I certainly take your point when you ask that question, in whose interest is it to have a vacant home? And, of course, as you say, the answer is, well, no one. It's in no one's interest. It's in no more the interest of local government than it would be in the interest of the owner or whoever it is that actually holds the deed to the property.
Right.
Yeah. Well, we have about 10 minutes left. We have a number of callers here. We'll try to get in as many as we can and take them in the order they came in. And first up is Bloomington, Illinois. Line one. Hello.
Yes, good morning. I like what this guy's talking about. I'm in that field, the real estate field, and what has happened is just it's taken a big, big hit. I happen to have, where I live, right next door to a house that's been sitting for 2.5 years.
Wow.
And it's actually pretty sad because these houses will sit. They'll decay, broken pipes, leaky roofs, critters, rats, you know, whatever. And the longer they sit, the worse it gets inside, the costlier it gets. And I guesstimate these banks. Unfortunately, I'm one of those few people out there that kind of wish the banks would have gone into bankruptcy.
Whoa.
Because they're basically, you know, to me, in my point of view, they weren't forced to take and do something about it. Now, your idea of working out something with the mortgage lenders and whatnot. I agree with that. I mean, I just don't understand. When I was had to buy a house in 94, when I built my house I'm in, I had to put 20% down. Every house I've ever had, up until a certain point, I had to put 20% down. All of a sudden, they let the bottom drop out. And because I'm a contractor, I see so many houses all over the state that are, you know, $600,000, $700,000, $800,000, $900,000 homes, and they have no money for interior stuff. You know, no money for clothes. They drive up a beautiful car because guess what? They forget they don't have the money for the maintenance of the house. They don't have the money, especially for the property taxes, and because this state has a way of burning people with their property taxes. I mean, it's not a friendly state to live in. I mean, I lived in different states. And heck, if I could find a job in another state, I'd be long gone because it doesn't favor me in any way. But the point is, the mortgage companies and the banking system in this country have allowed this to go on. And until we correct their problems, we won't get corrected.
Well, some people would say that what actually happened with the market restructuring is that we did, in fact, make mortgage companies much more healthy, banking industry much more healthy, Wall Street much more healthy, but we didn't do much to bail out homeowners themselves. And I'm not suggesting that I know that there are people who are against doing that, but there are also people who are against bailing out these financial institutions. And so one might argue that they are not hurting so much at this point, and they have now found new strategies for making money. Because at one point it really was by repossessing these homes and saying foreclosure is not necessarily bad for business because you get the value, but when the value has dropped, that's no longer the way that they can make money. And so perhaps a different strategy would be one that does more for the homeowners and tries to keep people in their homes and tries to do things to stabilize communities. Because that is a strategy that really hasn't been utilized that much. We've had Band-Aid kinds of things that have said, well, let's try to keep people there for 90 days, let's try to keep people there for 30 days, et cetera, to buy that kind of time. But nothing to keep neighborhoods stabilized. And so you have a lot of buildings that are shuttered. You have drops in property values because of the rates of vacancy and foreclosure in certain neighborhoods being so high that it devastates neighborhoods and it hurts what I would refer to as innocent victims, you know, people who live in those neighborhoods and taxpayers in those neighborhoods.
All right. Well, again, I appreciate the comments of the caller, and we're just going to keep on going here. We'll go next to somebody who is in Belgium, line number 3. Hello.
Hello, and good morning to you all. I'd like to hear your opinions about how Adam Smith has been actually proven out in this. And that is, during this period of time, we've invested in two very, very expensive wars that were totally unfunded. And Adam Smith says you can't have both guns and butter. We're going without the butter, guys.
Whoa, okay. Well, Adam Smith also believed in the notion of free markets and things along those lines. And he actually would have also suggested that we not engage in subsidizing bad decisions. And so the notion of there being a moral hazard, that is, if you make a bad decision, then you pay the price for making that bad decision. But what we didn't do, and I'm not arguing that we should have done it, because I believe that this could have been even more devastating to our economy if we had not bailed out Wall Street. But that is the thing, is that you really didn't have a lot of these institutions that got us in this mess suffer the way that the people who are homeowners are suffering. Now, in terms of the trade-off between war and domestic policy or international policy and domestic policy, that distinction gets blurred nowadays when we are talking about things like gasoline prices and things like that. So I'm not even sure if it's necessarily guns versus butter. It's guns and butter when you're talking about things that are affected by the global economy and the impact that they have on our domestic economy.
Well, again, thanks to the call. Let's go to the Quad Cities here, line four for someone else. Hello.
Hi. Yes, I have a couple of questions. The first one is, aren't we really taking a huge chance whenever we separate the selling and marketing of these mortgages from the ultimate risk that underlies these mortgages?
Well, that's actually the point that I'm that I've been making when I keep using this term moral hazard, is that in some sense, companies were allowed to make risky investments without there really being a risk on their part, because if they believe that they can get bailed out, then why not make a bad decision over and over and over? And that's kind of what we had, is financial institutions making bad bets. But then we, as the American populace, saying, but they're too big to fail, and so we can't let them fail.
Right. The only thing I'm adding to that is that on a strictly local level, the risk was avoided entirely by the people who sold the mortgages, because they carried no continuing risk once they'd sold them.
Well, so when you say the people who sold the mortgages...
I think he's talking about the whoever originated the mortgage.
Yeah.
They made the money off of the fees from the mortgage, and then in some cases very quickly handed it off to someone else.
We have a perverse system where you have one company making money by doing as many of these bad deals as they can, as quickly as they can, another company making money by bundling these bad deals and selling them to investors, and then another set of people, that is taxpayers, picking up the tab for those bad investments and those bundled investments and quick signings and all that kind of stuff. And so that's where we are. You're absolutely right.
So my last question is, shouldn't there be a better way of focusing capital, whether it's national, international, or whatever, on the mortgage situation than this system that brought us into all these defaults?
Well, there perhaps are. The thing is, and this gets tricky, because most people believe in capitalism. Most people in this country believe in capitalism. Some people would say that what we have with this market situation is not capitalism. And there are, in fact, some other solutions that don't look very much like capitalism either, and those are things like community banks or land banks that would take would lend money to communities, and then those communities would make decisions about who can acquire a mortgage and who needs to have a mortgage subsidized and things like that. So those strategies could be tried, too, and those do get closer to trying to bring more immediate help to people on the ground.
Well, and if you walk into a local bank
these days, there's resistance to those kinds of proposals.
If you walk into a local bank these days, you'll find that they're like morgues. There's nobody in the offices. It's just like they've got their little computer there to play the casino, and there isn't any real community there anymore.
Well, and that's why I'm saying perhaps it's time to do an end run on some of those kinds of institutions that are now kind of afraid to lend money. I mean, because that's really what's going on, is they feel that they have been burned, and the government gave them money, but, and I don't mean to say with no strings attached, but without little checks on how they would use the money. And so they are not necessarily reinvesting those funds in communities, because they believe many of these situations are still toxic, and so why are we going to go back down that path? And so they basically are holding on to those funds and being very conservative in terms of lending. But what I'm saying is the government actually could take some of those funds that it has been giving to these giant financial institutions and give it to communities, for those community land banks to make decisions about mortgages and things like that.
I want to ask, and I can only give you about a minute for the question,
sure,
but just you can put on maybe your sociologist hat for this one a little bit more. And that is, do you think that some people say the problem here is we were too aggressive about getting people into the housing market because we believe that that everyone, almost everybody, should own a home. Do you think that was a mistake?
Well, I don't know that I would say it was a mistake, but I would say that many people see home ownership as part and parcel of the American dream. And so we would like to think that a successful society is one that has higher proportions of people owning their homes, owning things of value, not a lower percentage of people. And so that's kind of what the tragedy is that we see when people are losing their homes, it is almost like they're falling out of the middle class, they're falling away from what most people think of being part of the American dream, and it is a nightmare for people for that reason. And so I don't think that we're too aggressive in terms of trying to promote home ownership, because it does so many good things for our economy. But the downside is that when that's going in the opposite direction, we see just the kind of devastating effect that it can, in fact, have on our economy and our local communities.
Well, there we're going to have to leave it. My apologies. I have one caller here we cannot take, but we're here at the end of the time, and we'll have to finish up with our thanks to our guest, Cedric Herring. He's professor of sociology at the University of Illinois Chicago, also affiliated with the Institute for Government and Public Affairs. You can read his contribution on the subject of the mortgage crisis in their Illinois report for 2011. And Professor Herring, thank you very much.
Thank you. It's been my pleasure.